So let's just go through sort of the clinical paradigm in ovarian cancer. We're going to work through the clinical paradigm in each one of these cancers very quickly. We can and have, and at SGO, we spend 2 hours talking about this, but let's just sort of go through it quickly. So Katie, a very common situation. Patient has debulking surgery, has a BRCA germline mutation. They're destined to get what I would call adjuvant chemo, or you guys don't necessarily call it that, but carboplatin. And the audience says that in general, they're going to follow that up with olaparib. That's based on the data from the SOLO-1 trial you're going to present. Seems like that's straightforward at this point, Katie. But the other issue that's kind of interesting is whether you bring bevacizumab in, because bevacizumab was actually recently approved in this setting, particularly the high-risk setting. Lots of questions. Do you add bev in? Do you just use a PARP inhibitor? A lot of people use bev during the chemo and then PARP inhibitor. Katie, what do you visualize as the acceptable alternatives, and what do you do?
I'm first glad to see that 92% of patients are going to use olaparib in the front line. That's reassuring, because that is the standard of care. There's not another standard of care. It is the standard of care. The results of SOLO-1 are unprecedented, and so there's not an equivalent option for these patients, and they should be offered olaparib and potentially another PARP inhibitor, and I feel very strongly about that. I guess I am biased, but you can't argue with a difference of 3 years in progression-free survival, I don't think. So that is the standard of care. I understand why people want to add bevacizumab. We know in several studies in ovarian cancer, when you add bevacizumab to chemotherapy, it does improve markedly the response rates. And so more so, I understand it in the recurrent setting where you're really trying to optimize the number of patients you get into a very good response so you can put them on one of three approved PARP inhibitors in that setting. In the front line, even in patients with bulky disease, the likelihood of achieving a complete response is very high. And so how much bevacizumab adds to that, I don't know that we really know, but I understand why people want to do it to try and optimize outcomes. There is a study that will result this year called PAOLA-1, which is ex-US, and it was run just a little bit after SOLO-1 and randomizes patients in Europe where bevacizumab is the standard of care with chemo and to follow. Once they had a complete or partial response, they were randomized to continue bevacizumab and placebo versus bevacizumab for 15 cycles and olaparib for 24 cycles as per SOLO-1. And it's stratified by BRCA mutation. So you have BRCA patients who received bevacizumab as alone, which of course we would not think is an acceptable comparator. So I think that's going to be a safety data set for this, and it will give us information in the wild-type patients more than the BRCA patients. I think it's going to be a little uninformative in that group, but it'll at least give us safety data. I don't think there's data for this yet, but I don't think it's necessarily egregious to do.
So a couple other clinical points, and then we'll take a look at the data. So another question, we're going to go back and forth all night about the implication of somatic BRCA, but in this situation, the audience is saying somatic, they're going to get a PARP inhibitor. I think almost everybody in the audience says that, and that is part of the indication, correct? The SOLO-1 post some type of PARP inhibitor, even if it's somatic, okay? And a little bit different than where we are right now with breast cancer, but completely accepted, standard of care, approved. Then we have this situation, which came up actually at the SGO meeting. We had some cases presented from the audience, and somebody had a patient who had gotten prior debulking surgery a year ago and wanted to use delayed PARP therapy. Interesting concept. Katie, the audience seems like they might be up for it even as much as a year ago, a year after the initial diagnosis. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, this is, I mean, as with any new indication, when you have patients that sort of missed the time window, it's so hard. I mean, I really do genuinely feel for these women that are in this gray zone, but we have no data to start olaparib a year after completion of chemotherapy in someone who is otherwise without evidence of disease. And you may just be wasting a very effective therapy that she's going to need later. So you're really sort of walking without data. And I'll show you the survival curves when we get to SOLO-1. The theory that we have is that the benefit of maintenance olaparib is probably very early in addressing the clonality of the tumor that's left after you've done induction chemotherapy. So it's a very early effect that seems to be maintained. So starting someone even 6 months beyond on this, I really can't support, although fully acknowledge what a difficult decision and conversation that is with patients. But I don't think we have the data to support that at all.
So it'd be interesting to get some of the faculty input as we go along. And I never heard this before, this vision that Katie has that it's an early effect, at least in this sort of adjuvant situation.